proof melting ice in Antarctica is directly related to global warming associated with human beings. The scientists studied the collapse of Antarctica's Larsen ice shelf 4 years ago. California and seven northeastern states will form a partnership to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The agreement will include a system permitting corporations to trade carbon emission credits. Researchers from Johns Hopkins University report a study showing a compound found in red wine may protect the brain following a stroke. The scientists say two glasses of wine daily should do the trick. The Mattel toy company today said it beat Wall Street expectations with a 6% increase in third quarter earnings. The company credited sales of Fisher-Price toys and products connected with the animated movie Cars. Charles Schwab announced a 29% jump in third quarter profit today. The online brokerage firm says the increase came from a surge in financial services revenue. Light sweet crude is $58.80 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Gold is $596.90 an ounce. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones is up 5 points, nearing the 12,000 mark at 11,965. The NASDAQ is up 5 points. The S&P 500 is up one. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levin.
No, it isn't. It's Bob Kincaid. And it's about 5 minutes past the hour. Welcome. Welcome to this Monday afternoon edition of the Radio Inside Scoop. I'm here because Mark Levin is out on the road. He's been attending a press conference this afternoon on the origins and deceptions involved in the beginning of the Iraq War. He's on his way back to the studio now. Mark, are you with us there?
Yes, I hear you now. I am driving home as we speak. It was an amazing, really, I can't wait till I get home and I can go through my notes with you. But David Korn and Michael Isikoff, David Korn, the editor of The Nation, and Michael Isikoff, investigative reporter from Newsweek, their new book has just come out, Hubris, and it goes into a lot of really amazing detail of the origins of the war in Iraq, and specifically on the origins of the propaganda campaign, you know, where it came from, where these ideas came from that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction or connections to Al-Qaeda, and really talking in detail about that. And so it was a fascinating seminar.
Well, it sounds like it certainly was. Now, you talk about these are certainly heavy hitters in terms of progressive media, especially David Korn. Did you hear? Okay, let me back up. We all know that the war is a fraud, right, Mark?
Well, yes, but the question at this point is where that fraud came from, because obviously, with Republicans in control of Congress, there hasn't been the kind of hearings and so forth that hopefully we'll have soon if the Democrats take over a House. I do expect they'll take over the House of Representatives. They may take the Senate as well. And so this is sort of a precursor, I think, to the kind of hearings, the information that will come out once the Democrats take control and are able to actually interview and ask these questions that the Republicans don't ask.
Okay, well, that certainly makes sense. So was this, do you consider this as something of a precursor to what you expect from a Democratic majority in the Congress?
I think so. I mean, there's a lot of really good stuff that came out. You know, I'm driving right now, so I can't go through my notes at the moment, but there's stories that I want to go into. One of the main ones, interestingly, is apparently the godfather, if you will, the forerunner, the person who came up with the idea that Saddam Hussein had some connection to 9/11, was a staffer at a foundation, a conservative foundation called the American Enterprise Institute. Now, there certainly were people in Washington in the 1990s that were looking for ways to get Saddam Hussein. Many of those names are very familiar to listeners, people like Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Fife, Richard Pearl, and others. But they needed sort of a connection. They sort of knew that America wouldn't go for a war just because they wanted to take out Saddam and because he tried to kill George Bush's daddy or any of those reasons. And they were looking for a connection, and they knew that certainly Americans were angry after September 11th and knew that that's one thing that Americans would be willing to go to war on, you know, whoever caused 9/11. And so they found this this old article, if you will, the American Enterprise Institute, by this woman named Laura Mulroney. And as I said, she's a staffer for the Conservative Institute. And it was her theory that Saddam Hussein was behind virtually every major terrorist attack of our time. Certainly the 1993 World Trade Center, she blamed on Iraqi intelligence. She blamed the attack on African embassies. That she blamed the attack on the USS Cole. She even, by the way, blamed the attack on Oklahoma City on Iraqi intelligence. At one point, she even volunteered for the Timothy McVeigh defense team because she was going to argue that, in fact, he didn't blow up the Oklahoma City Federal Center. It was actually Iraqi intelligence. She volunteered for the team until Timothy McVeigh's own defense attorney, who at first welcomed any idea that his client may not be guilty, finally had to reject her analysis as crackpot. But she is the hero. She is the one who, to whom people who wanted to invade Iraq were looking for. And so a lot of her theories became sort of accepted wisdom as the connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11 that was later cited by the neocons in their run-up to the war. And this is a person who I hadn't heard before, so that was, a very interesting scoop.
Surprisingly, well, maybe not. I have heard of you know, she was widely discredited. I mean, a crackpot among crackpots. The only thing she didn't manage to get around to blaming Saddam for was the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, and I'm sure she's still working on it, Mark.
I think he did that. He went back in time. It was a very complex maneuver. It's, you know, too complex for us to understand, but I think he did cause that.
Well, that was back when he kidnapped Sherman and Mr. Peabody and the Wayback Machine. Yes. It's abundantly obvious that there is a great deal of evidence that needs to be combed through, and one of the things that that's been a problem for us is the sort of helter-skelter, harum-scarum approach we've had to take to understanding, you know, exactly how this happened. Certainly, you and they are absolutely correct. People were preyed upon. The fears of people. Very human urge for vengeance was preyed upon, but it was preyed upon with a level of cynicism that I don't know if we've ever seen in the American body politic. You know, at one point, 70% of Fox viewers were utterly convinced that Saddam not only was involved, but did 9/11. I welcome these people's efforts, and I hope the book gets great outreach.
Well, I think it is. I'll tell you, one thing I guess I don't know if I agree with you that this was the most cynical in American history. We've seen these things in the past. I think specifically of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in Vietnam, where ambiguous incident.
But Mark, there wasn't a project for a new American century before the Gulf of Tonkin resolution out there hawking a policy paper that said all we need is a new Pearl Harbor and we're good to go.
That's certainly true. So I guess I think back in American history, the Spanish-American War, I'm sure many of us do not remember 1898. I wasn't around then.
It's a little foggy for me.
We had the USS Maine, a ship out near the Philippines, blow up in a boiler accident, and the rallying cry of "Remember the Maine" got us into a war with Spain, the Spanish-American War. So what's interesting is presidents certainly have a history of at least taking ambiguous events and using them to hype us into war. But here we have a case where really there wasn't that much ambiguity. One of the interesting things they put out in the book, and this has come out a little bit in the press, is the plot by Bush to make a pretext for war. They hired a general, I have the name in my notes, an Iraqi general, and what he was going to do was take a base, an Iraqi base, probably near the Saudi Arabia border, so if he needed U.S. support, he could get it, and forced Saddam Hussein to put him down. And hopefully Saddam Hussein would then breach the no-fly zone. And that would be the pretext for war. I have to say, it kind of reminds me of Hitler's claim September 1st, 1939, that Poland invaded Germany.
Yes.
And that's why he needed to fight back. And what about this particular general, the pretext apparently wasn't used because Bush felt he could sort of do it on his own. But this general, they describe in the book, comes in the spring of 2004, so the Iraqi war is already, 2 years old then, and says, look, we don't even have Baghdad, you know, much less the rest of the Iraqi countryside. We can't even secure the road between the green zone and the airport. And if you can't secure the road between the main way, you know, troops and supplies are coming in and our headquarters in the green zone, we've got a severe problem. And Korn Isakov stated in the book, the general looked around and Bush looked shocked and Cheney said nothing and no one asked any questions. And then Bush gave him a souvenir tie clip and they stood up for pictures.
Oh, God.
And then afterwards, Rice said, let me know what's going on. And he sent several missives in the future, and Rice never responded. But it's this sort of willful disbelief. You know, when you find facts that don't fit with your preconceived notions, it was almost embarrassment. He felt embarrassed. There was like a pin drop in the room when he said these things, and everyone sort of exchanged surprised glances, he said, at each other, like, you know, why is he telling us this? And, of course, nothing was done about it.
Well, because, you know, it's the Oval Office these days, Mark, is somewhat similar to that line in, from Home on the Range, where never is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy all day. You don't.
Well, I think of The Wiz, "Don't Bring Me No Bad News" song.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure, exactly. So, you know, they're not accustomed, are they, to hearing reality? I mean, they heard reality from Eric Shinseki. You know, I mean, this guy's got a shoulder board full of star-shaped jewelry, and he goes in and says, "Look, guys, it's going to take you 500,000 people to hold Iraq."
Right.
And then Rumsfeld looks up and goes, "No, it's not."
No, it's not. Rumsfeld said, you know, take 40,000 max and they'd be out. He said, it might take 6 days, it might take 6 weeks, but it won't take 6 years.
Yeah.
Well,
that's our rummy.
6 years. You know, and of course, then there's Paul Wolfowitz who says it was self-financing. There'd be enough oil there that we wouldn't pay a thing. So it was only off by $300 billion and counting or so.
Yeah, it's gonna be a bargain. We'll be welcomed with flowers and chocolates.
But one of the things I think that really came across from the authors is that this is a group that was really searching for any kind of justification they could find. And one of the things I really focused in the questioning on after they gave their talk was the National Intelligence Estimate of 2002, because that's what I remembered when I worked in Congress. Of course, we well knew that the National Intelligence Estimate, which is supposed to be the gold standard, you know, the great standard for all the intelligence agencies put together,
right.
We knew that Saddam Hussein wasn't even mentioned in 2001 as a threat, or 2000, or 99. There have been several years where it was very well understood by the National Intelligence Agencies, as well as people like Colin Powell, who said in Egypt in February,
exactly,
2001,
just...
as well as a lot of people in the Army said, hey, this guy's boxed in. The understanding was, you know, he was not the nicest guy in the world, but he wasn't a threat. In fact, he was a bigger threat at the time of the Persian Gulf War than indeed he was in 2002. His army was a third the size. It had very little power. Morale was low. He you know, wasn't... They weren't aware of any weapons of mass destruction, but he wanted them. You know, if he could get away from the sanctions for a while, he would rebuild them. But that was about it.
Well, the fact of the matter is, yeah, he's a jerk. Yeah, he's brutal. He's nasty. He's not anybody you want living next door to you. But he did happen to live next door to a bunch of loonies in Iran.
Right.
And so you put me in the same or similar circumstance, and I would suspect I could say the same thing with you, Mark. You know, Dictator Mark, Dictator Bob, we're going to want to have a nice little army to counteract the possibility of a bunch of screaming crazies coming across the border from Iran as well.
Well, let's not forget that Iran-Iraq fought one of those brutal wars in the last 30 years. More than 1 million people died in the Iran-Iraq War. Iraq, of course, is a majority Shiite state, run at that time by a Sunni dictator, which is very important. Let's not, I mean, when you think of the differences, religious differences in other countries, this is a major religious difference.
Yeah, this isn't the difference between the Presbyterians and the Lutherans.
No, it really isn't. You have to kind of go back to the days of the Inquisition to understand this kind of animosity. And so Iraq did fear that Iran would come in. And what's interesting is that today, we are largely creating the kind of Iraq that Saddam Hussein feared, an Iraq controlled by the Shiites, an Iraq largely controlled by Iran, which, frankly, compared to Saddam Hussein, it makes Saddam Hussein look like, you know, no problem at all.
Well, that, you know, it's, I guess it's the law of unintended consequences hard at work, Mark. This was the exact what has developed in Iraq, as a matter of fact, and I'm no George H.W. Bush fan, but it is exactly what people like Brent Scowcroft looked at George H.W. Bush, 41, and said, this is why you're not going to Baghdad now.
And people like, guess what, Dick Cheney also said that we're not going to Baghdad in the Persian Gulf War. And I think what they had was a little bit of buyer's remorse. And the irony is that my personal belief, you may disagree with me, but that back in 91, in the Persian Gulf War, aftermath, when you had the Shiites rising up and you had the Kurds rising up, at that time, it actually might have made sense to give air support. I wouldn't have done troops, but to give air support to Iraqis overthrowing their own government.
Well, that's what we promised to do. I mean, the CIA told the Shia in the south, down around Basra, whatever, they said, rise up, ye mighty Shia. And the Shia rose up, and the CIA said, see ya!
Exactly. And the irony is that I think that it's sort of generally accepted hindsight, though at the time, I remember pushing, you know, for it. I remember, General Schwarzkopf was in favor of going on. And, but, you know, they were holding back, saying, you know, we don't know the consequences. Who knows? But the difference, of course, is that then it would have been truly an Iraqi revolution. The Iraqis would have taken over. We might have helped them with a little bit of air support, but it wouldn't have required any U.S. troops. We could have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein. What would have happened? I don't know, but it certainly would be better than the chaos that we have today.
Well, there wouldn't be 2,700 dead Americans as a result of it.
That's certainly true.
There wouldn't be 20,000 plus permanently maimed and crippled Americans as a result of it. You know, I'd say the little known statistic of the week last week, Mark, was this this figure that came out and that said up to a half a million Iraq war vets are coming home and filing for disability. Now, I don't mean to get all fiscally conservative or anything, but that doesn't bode well. You know, that's going to be a financial drain that certainly this administration is not prepared to cope with based on its budget projections for Veterans Affairs, and that is criminal.
And perhaps a third has post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
It's a major problem.
And it'll take maybe 10, 15 years to find out what the depleted uranium did.
Well, I think I can get access to the mic now. If you'll take a break, Bob, I'll try to get
Let's
back
do
on
that. We've shot right through it. We will take a break, Mark, and you come back on the bright and shiny microphone, and we're going to continue this. This is the Radio Inside Scoop. I'm Bob Kincaid. Mark Levine will be around here in just a moment. Stick around.
What's Head On with Bob Kincaid? This is Head On with Bob Kincaid.
The only hope that George Bush had after he raped the Treasury, after he ripped us off, the only hope he had for balancing out the amount of bad paper that he had to go and hang in China was to take control of the means by which China would receive oil. Iraq is one of the faucets. The other faucet is Iran. If he can control those two things, he can continue to hang bad paper on China, and on the other end, act as the dealer outside the schoolyard to China's little junkie. Does this make sense?
It makes perfect sense, but I haven't heard it said in that concise a manner. Nobody has made the loop so small that everybody can realize.
Head On with Bob Kincaid, Monday through Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern, only at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and RadioPower.org.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water, use it wisely.
Did you receive an email from the IRS saying you're due a tax refund? If so, don't open it. The IRS does not request personal information by email. Hi, I'm Russell George, Treasury Inspector General for Tax. The IRS and I want to warn you about bogus IRS emails and websites that look real, but are not. These emails are schemes played by crooks who are out to steal your money and identity. Fall victim to it, and you can spend months, even years, cleaning up the mess they've made of your good name and credit record. Help stop these crooks from ripping people off. If you get a suspicious email, forward it to phishing@irs.gov. That's phishing at irs.gov. Or call us at 1-800-366-4484. Again, that's 1-800-366-4484. Thank you.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm not sure right now whether it's Bob or me that should be announcing it, but
yeah, we're both here.
We're both here. I am now in studio. One of the advantages of being in Washington, D.C., of course, is that I can go and hear from the insiders exactly what's going on. One of the disadvantages is that a lot of times they have these things right during my show. I wish they could be more considerate, but they wouldn't move the event.
Yeah, we got to have a talk with these people.
we really should. But the book is an excellent book. In fact, I'm going to try to get David Korn on my show later. He and I had a real nice discussion during, and then I had to book out of there to try to be on the radio here. But there's just so much about it, so many wonderful little details that I haven't heard at least come out before. Bob, you may know some of these. But one of the ones that he mentions has to do with the plans for the war afterwards. And they talk about a conversation between Bush and General Tommy Franks. Now, Bush, according to authors Korn and Isikoff, was very much interested in the details of the invasion. How many troops, where do we send them, do we use Turkey, how do we get them in, that kinds of stuff. But apparently in all the run-up to the war in Iraq, there were only two times that Bush ever asked about after the invasion. At one point, he asked Tommy Franks, you know, are there any plans after the invasion? And Franks says yes. His idea is he's going to appoint a Lord Mayor in every Iraqi city. So Bush sort of nods, and they go on, and they talk about
did he actually use, I mean, was this David Korn exaggerated? Did he use the term Lord Mayor?
Absolutely, Lord Mayor. This is not an exaggeration. This was Frank's term, a Lord Mayor. Prince George wants Lord Mayors. I guess it's all part of the feudalistic culture.
Well,
I don't know.
Darn, you know, if we'd hung on long enough, maybe we could have had a viceroy.
Well, maybe that
was Paul Bremer.
Paul Bremer was the viceroy. But there was a second time, I should point out, that Bush does ask about post-Iraq invasion. It occurs about a week or two later, where Bush asked Franks, now, what are we doing after the invasion again? And, Franks is a bit in a peak because he did tell the president, and he says, Mr. President, I told you we're going to appoint a Lord Mayor in every Iraqi city. And Bush says, oh, yeah, right, okay, I forgot. And then they go on and talk about other things. So it's not that they didn't plan for the post-invasion. There you hear the entire post-war invasion plans, at least at the top of the hierarchy.
That's it.
Now, one of the things that that Korn Isikoff points out is that at the bottom of the hierarchy, there were Americans working hard on post-war plans. They cite Kevin Benson, and he worked for the Third Army, which was the main army going in there, the leading force there. And he was working on post-war plans. I guess he felt it was prudent. And he figured that Iraq is about the size of California in both population and landmass. So he went and he found out, because it's easy to find out this kind of stuff, how many police officers are in the state of California, how many judges, how many prisons,
basically thinking, you know, we have to approximate this, figuring that California is a bit more stable than Iraq, despite what some non-Californians would think, and that it's a bit more stable than Iraq, so we need at least this number. You know, there's a couple hundred thousand people who run California government, so we're going to need at least that number in Iraq. And he puts it up in a nice glossy report that there's no evidence that anyone in the higher-ups ever even saw. Tommy Franks, the general who had the idea of the Lord Mayor, never seems to have used Kevin Benson's report.
Well, General Jay Garner come into this discussion anywhere along the way, Mark?
I have to look through my notes, but what's your recollection?
He's the guy who was originally appointed viceroy. And,
oh, right, before Bremer.
Yeah, before Bremer. He gets to Baghdad, he sets the suitcases down, and suddenly he gets a phone call from Don Rumsfeld saying, don't unpack. Because Bremer was operating on a sort of MacArthur post-World War II model that said, we want to get everything up and reconstituted as quickly as possible, we want to have elections as soon as practicable, and we want to turn the government back over to the Iraqis. In as short order as possible. Rumsfeld gets wind of this, Jay Garner doesn't get a chance to warm the chair behind the desk before he's out.
Yeah, they didn't talk about Jay Garner. Of course, though, they didn't go through the entire book. One of the people they did talk about is Admiral Thomas Wilson, who was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. You know, a lot of people, when they think about intelligence, they think about the CIA. That's sort of the one that all of us know about. That's the one that's in the movies, right?
Yeah.
But what I don't think most Americans realize is that there's some 15 intelligence agencies in the country, and that 10 of them work for the Pentagon. There's defense underneath the Defense Intelligence Agency, and I think many would argue that the DIA has more power than the CIA. Notably because they don't get so much oversight because Americans don't know about it. They're not telling their member of Congress to overlook the DIA. But Admiral Thomas Wilson was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency from 1999. He began under Clinton until the summer of 2002 when he was fired, interestingly enough, summer of 2002. Interesting if you remember that that's about the time that we're going into Iraq. But in the spring of 2002, just before the Iraqi invasion, or I guess in the beginning of it, he is brought before Congress for testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And he says, in effect, what I said as I was driving home, that Saddam Hussein's military is severely weakened, that it's not near as powerful as it was during the Persian Gulf War, about a third as much power. They have very bad equipment. There may be some residual chemical and biological weapons left over from 1991.
Right.
They didn't have any proof of that, but, you know, there could be some left over. You know, it makes me think that maybe Germany still has some World War I stocks of mustard gas, and so given that chemical weapons, maybe we need to reinvade there. I don't know. But he says there's no reconstitution of nuclear weapons and no connection to Al-Qaeda. And so what's interesting is that the truth was there all along in the midst of the lies. You just kind of had to pull it out.
Well, to go back to something you mentioned while you were still on your way into the studio, Mark, the one thing I don't understand is there is video evidence. You've seen it. I've seen it. It's Colin Powell standing there in Egypt talking to the press, talking to the Egyptian leadership, saying something, yeah, I'm paraphrasing, but not too far from the actual quote, Saddam Hussein is utterly unable to threaten his neighbors in the least.
February 2001 in Cairo.
Yeah.
To be exact.
July of either 2001 or 2002, Condoleezza Rice sits down on the set at CNN in Washington, D.C., and looks Wolf Blitzer squarely in the eye and says, he can't threaten us. He's powerless. He can't do it. There's no there. And what I'm wondering about is
he himself, by the way, said it right after September 11th.
Yeah.
He came on the press and was asked about Saddam Hussein, and the idea was no, he was pretty much hemmed in, which I think was one of the only accurate things Dick Cheney has ever said.
So, Mark, how is it that the American people and frankly even the Democrats in Congress who voted to authorize the war and all of that hoopla How is it that they got conned into this thing, you know, and after it's all over and we find out that the war was a fraud, is a fraud, and how is it the Bush administration gets away with saying, well, you know, we all just did, we depended on bad intelligence, it's the CIA's fault, when it was Bush administration officials sitting there in front of rolling cameras saying, we know the man is not a threat?
Well, I think it's a fair question, and I think that really my experience working in Congress, I remember those days. I remember focusing on Afghanistan. There was a time after September 11th when we thought, wrongly in hindsight, but we thought the country was going to come together. Bush had been snuck into office by the Supreme Court. We were very angry about that, but heck, our country was under attack. We were going to join together at least to fight the threat, and we were all focused on Afghanistan. And I remember very much the spring of 2002 and going into the summer and people starting to mention Iraq. And our heads were like, Iraq? What are you talking about? And I think the heart of what got the Democrats in trouble was trust, if you will, and the fear that they'd be seen as wrong if they didn't trust the president. I'll give you the specific example, and they raise it in the book. And that has to do with the infamous war resolution, the one that Kerry unfortunately got so flustered on that he never gave a good explanation for. But I remember what it was at the time. And, of course, the goal was something that the great majority of Republicans and Democrats supported, which was to get inspectors into Iraq to make sure that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction or to find the ones that were there. Because you can't prove a negative. We couldn't prove, and we can now, but we couldn't prove back in 02 that there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no evidence that there was any, but there was no evidence that there wasn't any either. And about the only way to prove that was to get the inspectors in on the ground. Well, Saddam, prior to this resolution, had indeed kicked the inspectors out. And so the Democrats felt, I felt, frankly, at the time, that you have to threaten force in order to get Saddam Hussein to let the inspectors in. So the idea was threaten force and Saddam Hussein will let the inspectors in and we won't have to actually go to war. And the irony is that that worked, if you will. The resolution, the threat of war, did get Saddam Hussein to get the inspectors in. The inspectors were in. They were allowed to go everywhere, including his palaces. People forget that that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And then Bush changed his mind and said, it doesn't matter what the inspectors find. We're going to war anyway. And so the resolution, people forget, was done at a time when the argument was you have to threaten the use of force in order to get the inspectors in. And one of the things that they talk about is, and this is important to understand the distinction, is the various Democratic and Republican resolutions on how to do this. The original plan, and this was done by Senator Biden, who, has always been very focused on getting rid of Saddam Hussein. But at the same time, you can disagree with how focused he is on it, but I think, you know, he's certainly an intelligent man. He had a resolution along with Lugar and Hagel, Republicans, who are not necessarily following the president's bidding. And their resolution was to threaten force in order to get the inspectors in, but not authorize war. The idea was if the inspectors then found weapons of mass destruction, they could go back to Congress and get a resolution authorizing war, and that would then be a war to get rid of the weapons of mass destruction. And the Biden-Lugar resolution was actually, there were some Republicans that were supporting it. It's kind of made sense. You do one to get the inspectors in, and then if you have to go to war as a last resort, you do another. Well, George Bush at the time personally, and this is in Cor Nizakov's book, called Trent Lott, who was the leader of the Senate, the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, and said, you derail this motion at any cost. And one unfortunate ally that Trent Lott had in this was the leader of the Democrats in the House, Richard Gephardt. Now, Richard Gephardt was running for president, and he had voted against the Persian Gulf War. So unlike someone like Al Gore, who voted for the Persian Gulf War and could inoculate himself against the idea that he was a defeatist or a pacifist, Gephardt had voted against the Persian Gulf War. And his advisors told him, this is in Cor Nizakov's book, that he couldn't vote against this war as well and have any chance of any success in the presidential race.
Because, and that was the motivating base, his presidential ambitions.
That's what they said. Exactly right. His presidential ambitions. He stood with the president, literally next to his side, as they got rid of the more nuanced Biden resolution, which, you know, I think actually in my mind made sense. We can disagree on it, but I think threatening force in order to get the inspectors in made sense, whereas the actual use of force didn't. You get the inspectors in. If they are developing weapons of mass destruction, you discover it. You can act against it. After all, Clinton had inspectors in when there was some weapons there. And again, we should talk about this whole term, weapons of mass destruction, because it's a misnomer. There's chemical and biological weapons, which are one thing. They were used in World War I. And then there's nuclear, which is a whole other thing. But there were some chemical and biological leftover weapons. We had inspectors in there under Bill Clinton from 91 till 98. They found the weapons and they destroyed them. So that sort of made sense to a number of Democrats. But when Gephardt said, I'm going to support this stronger resolution, all the Republican support for the Biden compromise fell through. They wouldn't be seen as less aggressive than Dick Gephardt. So I think it's important for people to understand the politics of what happened and also to remember the vote. It isn't like the Democrats voted overwhelmingly for the war resolution. In the House, where I was working, 60% of Democrats voted against that resolution. Certainly a decent minority, 40% did. Yeah. In the Senate, it was kind of the reverse. 60% of the Democrats voted for the resolution. But they didn't have the Biden compromise, which I think made a lot of sense to those people who believe that we need to watch Saddam Hussein, but also believe that war is a last resort. So I think that explains a lot of what's going on. And I think if John Kerry had made a little bit more clear in the election campaign that this was a vote not to go to war, but a vote to authorize war if Saddam Hussein didn't come clean, and made clear that he wasn't allowed to vote on an alternative because the Biden resolution was never put to a vote. Maybe that, I don't know, but that's the truth of what happened. Whether he could have conveyed it to the American people in 2004 or not, I don't know.
Well, I got to say, I rather doubt it, having heard him speak personally on a number of occasions, Mark. The guy spoke in paragraphs.
Well, that's true. He certainly never, and it's not easy to convey. It's just not easy for...
It's not easy to explain to the American people. But the American people, 2000, 2004, seemed to be suffering from a profound case of attention deficit disorder, wherein they could only understand two words at a time, gay marriage, big rocks in schools. And some of that is the Rovian philosophy, Mark, of, bumper sticker politics. But, this is not the kind of state where old men sit around playing chess in the park and discussing the relative merits of policy.
I think, though, it wasn't impossible to explain. I think we all understand that, if you threaten a child with a spanking, that doesn't mean you want to spank your child. It means that you're trying to get someone who's acting up to behave. And what you say to the child is not, I'm going to spank you no matter what. What you say is, you do what I say or I'll spank you. And that's not so hard for people to understand. And that's, in essence, what the Democrats thought the resolution was about. Joe Biden stood on the floor of the Senate and said, with this resolution, we are averting war. Because we're saying, Saddam Hussein, if you don't act, we will go to war. And the irony is, the resolution, if it had been, for example, if Bill Clinton had been president, if we didn't have a warmonger who was our president, that was the kind of resolution that Democrats would want and would want Republicans to support, a resolution saying, if you don't do what we say, we'll go to war. And what did Saddam Hussein do? He rolled over. He said, all right, fine, bring your inspectors in. And they were going around.
And we forget that he complied with the UN resolution, that he provided reams upon reams upon reams of documents showing that he had no so-called WMDs. And, of course, the right wing, if you recall, Mark, came out and said, well, dang, he turned in a bunch of documents, but they was in Arabic.
Right.
What do they want it in, Czech?
Well, Arabic, by the way, is one of the six UN formal approved languages.
Yes, it is.
It's actually an international language. But, of course, it's come out recently that of our 12,000 FBI agents, less than 1% claim any knowledge. And of the ones that claim knowledge, more than half of them, according to a test, had no knowledge. And six agents out of 12,000 were rated 4 out of 5, 0 were rated 5 out of 5. So, of course, this is an administration that fires our best Arabic translators because they're gay. So,
right, yeah.
It's a good point.
Well,
should we... Go ahead. Should we invite callers to join in?
Well, yeah, certainly. I rather assume that that goes without saying. But, yeah, if there's a comment to be made or a question to be asked, the phone number is quite easy. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4. Head on. Mark, if it's okay, we'll take a quick break and come back and roll it on down toward the top of the hour.
Fair enough.
All right. Sounds good. This is the Radio Inside Scoop. That's Mark Levine. Let them know you're there, Mark.
I'm here.
Okay, good. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be right back.
United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day.
Recently on the Guy James
Recently
Show.
On the Guy James.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. One of the advantages of being in Washington, of course, is that I can hear a lot of the inside stories as they come out. And I've just come back from a presentation by authors Michael Isikoff of Newsweek and David Korn of The Nation talking about their new book, Hubris. And I've got a bunch of notes here, really some good stuff on the inside story in Iraq. But they had the audacity to schedule it right before the radio show, so I had to jump in the car. And Bob Kincaid has been helping me out with hosting the show until I could get in studio, and I very much appreciate that. I do want to talk more about some of what they said, because there's just a lot of good little details. One of the things that they point out, is this actually came out in questioning, is trying to find out what was the real reason. This is, I guess, what really gnaws at a lot of us. What was the real reason they went to war? And, you know, anytime you're trying to speculate or get into someone's mind, it's a very hard thing to do. But one of the things they point out in their book is that in May 2002, Ari Fleischer, he was the press secretary, of course, at the time, is telling George Bush what happened that morning and how Helen Thomas, the inveterate Helen Thomas, the elderly person, the queen of the press corps, if you will, though she's been around since Eisenhower and traditionally always asked the first question for every president until George W. Bush actually shut her up, but was asking, why are we so determined to expel Iraq by force? So Ari Fleischer conveys this to George W. Bush in the Oval Office, and Bush has a fit. He has a visceral, angry reaction. He says, I will kick his blankety blank. I don't think I can say that on the radio. I will kick his blank all across the Mideast. He just simply blows up at the idea of a diplomatic solution. At one point, Tom Daschle talks to him about diplomatic solution, and he literally raises his middle finger, we all know what that means, inches from Tom Daschle's face, and says, this is what Saddam Hussein thinks of the United States. And then, of course, the last major psychological thing that we all know well came from a fundraiser for Senator Cornyn of Texas when asked about Saddam Hussein. Again, this is right before the 2002 election. He said, that's the guy who tried to kill my dad. And I think sometimes if you ask the reason, at least in Bush's mind, it is this sort of pure psychological visceral reaction. Now, I don't know that that's true for some of the others. For Cheney, it may have been about oil. For Wolfowitz and Pearl, it may have been about this idea we're going to remake the Middle East. They may have all had very different reasons. But it's interesting that for Bush, it really was this sort of psychology of his dad had screwed it up, and he was going to fix it, and he was going to make it better. One of the things they point out, they were asked rationales for going into war, whether Israel was a focus, and they said, well, it may have been that they were trying to be more Catholic than the Pope, that some of the people in America wanted to protect Israel more than Israel itself wanted to be protected. But what they point out is that the Israeli government was not interested in a war with Iraq. They actually discouraged America from doing it. They felt that Iran was the greater threat. There were some elements in the right-wing Likud party that was not in power at that time that was interested in Iraq, but that certainly wasn't what the Israeli government was interested in. So just a lot of good insights. They talk about the 2002 election and how it is that they really felt they needed to roll it out like a public relations company. As I said, one of the things that I focused on, because I remember it in Congress, is the National Intelligence Estimate of 2002. Because in my view, insider's view, and again, I was in the House, not the Senate, and largely it was the Senate that was making these decisions, but I would say that the National Intelligence Estimate of 2002 did more than just about any other single document in encouraging Democratic members of Congress, those half or so that voted for the war in Iraq. It's actually a minority, but a strong minority, to convince them to do it. And, of course, you remember the National Intelligence Estimate of 2002 this is the gold standard of intelligence. This is supposed to be what all the intelligence agencies agree on as the truth. And one of the things I remembered was that in the intelligence estimate of 01 and 2000 and 1999, there's no mention of Saddam Hussein as a threat, as a significant threat to the United States. There's no mention of weapons of mass destruction. And so I asked Korn and Isikoff, I said, well, what about this? What happened? Why in 02 was there such a big threat that wasn't mentioned in 01? And they said, well, actually, there was none in 2002 either. And, in fact, it was a lot of the Democrats who were saying, in the Senate Democrats, were saying to Cheney and others, hey, we need a national intelligence estimate. Hey, Rumsfeld, where is the proof that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction? We need a NIE. So apparently they slapped it together in 12 days. They had the standard NIE, the one that had been put out over the year, that had been carefully done, and they had 12 days to throw in this extra section on Saddam Hussein. And as I reported when I first went on the radio in 03, the things that said that Saddam Hussein was a danger, that was all in the public materials. That was all in the materials that were shown to us, the white paper, they call it, the declassified notion. In the original NIE, it said things like, we think, it's possible. And, of course, in the footnotes and the dissents, they would have things like, oh, the Energy Department doesn't think this is true, and the U.S. State Department doesn't think this is true, and the Air Force doesn't think that unmanned drones are a danger. The Energy Department doesn't think that the aluminum tubes are being used for nuclear weapons. So the footnotes and all made clear that the main text wasn't true. And then the main text, when it was declassified, said that, in fact, things that they weren't sure about became things they were sure about. Now, why didn't people read the materials. You can still hear Republicans to this day say, well, the Democrats said they had all the information we had and they went to war. Well, it was a classified document. And the way you could get to read it was they had it in the Capitol. You had to go during certain reading hours with sort of an armed police officer standing over your shoulder in the middle of a very big congressional season, right, you know, right before elections. And people had to go by, and they had to read it personally. And, you know, I got to tell you how things work in Congress. Normally, staff reads the documents, you know, particularly a document of this size. And the staff goes, and they put it in form for their member. Some members are better than others. Certainly, Senator Graham of Florida, more than any other, went in. Bob Graham, he was the head of the Democratic Senate Intelligence Committee. And he was the lead Democrat. He went in and he read it. And he was sounding the alarm. And I remember in 2002 him sounding the alarm and saying, this is not what they say it is. But then reporters would ask him, well, what does it really say? And he said, I can't tell you. The document is classified. So when Graham demanded that the CIA, that George Tenet, put out a declassified version, that's when they put out the changed one. That's when they took out the, we don't know that he has weapons of mass destruction, but he could have them, and it became, we know he has weapons of mass destruction. And so the irony is, here Graham was trying to get the public to find out that the NIE was saying that, you know, it's not so clear, and by the very act of doing that, by the very act of demanding it to be classified, they put out a document that changed a political document that was trying to emphasize the worst and hide the good to simply saying the worst is true. So manipulating the facts around the intelligence, you know, as the Downing Street memo said, it's more than that. It's actually creating intelligence because you change it a little and you change it a little and soon it says exactly the opposite of what it has to say. So, you know, the Democrats were tricked. Now, I don't say that with any joy. I don't say that. I mean, certainly they should have all gone and read the document in the Capitol, as Senator Graham did. But most didn't. And that ship had sailed. And most realized that they would be called the cut and runners if they did. So I do have to say this, though. I think, I hope, I pray, the Democrats have learned a lesson. And when in the next run-up to war, which may be going on with Iran, that I think they're going to be less likely simply to accept the president's word for it. But one of the things that they pointed out is that Dick Armey, the second in command of the Republicans in Congress, himself had questions about this and told President Bush that if Clinton had given him these kinds of assertions, he would have said it's all BS. But he was going to be a loyal partisan, and they demanded he not speak out about it until afterwards, and of course he didn't. So there's so many details here. I do highly recommend the book, Hubris. I am going to try to get David Korn on the air to talk about some of these details. But the heart of the issue, I think, is that when you put together a campaign based on fear in the wake of September 11th, one of the things Republicans understood is that totally apart from whether Iraq had any connection to September 11th, which we now know to be absolutely false, they understood that America was scared. They understood that the events of September 11th caused us to be frightened. And they knew the lessons of 1984, Big Brother, that America, and any people, it's not America, any people turns toward a dictator when they're frightened. I mean, you can look at Hitler in the 30s, you can look at the Soviet Union. It's hard times that lead people to demand dictatorship-like solutions. Heck, in the 30s. At the time of the Great Depression, there were those that were arguing that FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, needed to take more dictatorial powers, and they knew that the country was ripe for it, because when people are afraid and they're scared, they are more ripe to accept a dictator. And certainly they knew that, and they knew that it was ripe for the picking. And look at what they did to a guy like Max Cleland, right? Senator Max Cleland of Georgia, a Vietnam vet who lost three limbs, two legs and an arm in the war, fighting for his country, and they in effect called him a traitor because he wanted to keep the same labor protections in the Department of Homeland Security that we've had in all our government departments for some 40, 50 years. And, you know, they had Osama bin Laden and him right next to it. So It's amazing what people do when they're scared. And it's not just the American people. It's politicians, because they know that American people, well, are going to be scared. They're going to take action. So what's interesting to me is, for all the conspiracy theories about Bush causing 9/11, which I don't believe, there can be no doubt that he recognized the opportunity. Probably not Bush. Karl Rove recognized the opportunity. And they were determined to connect Iraq to September 11th. And that's one of the reasons why they didn't look at the post-invasion plans. Because if they looked at it, and they looked at it in detail, it might seem less complex. It might seem, more complex than they knew it was. And so the idea is, just give the country to Chalabi, and just have Lord Mayors, and they'll greet us as liberators. And we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. And the amazing thing is, a lot of Americans bought it. And one of the main reasons I got into radio in June 2003 was seeing this travesty go on. I wanted to expose it. And frankly, in some ways, it's amazing to me that it took 3 years for such a good book like Hubris to be written to expose it. So that's it for the Inside Scoop. Tune in tomorrow. We've got a debate Tuesday. I'm going to take on Republican Mike Lane and ask him some of these difficult questions of why we're in Iraq. I want to hear how he tries to weasel out of it. And I hope you'll check that out tomorrow. Thank you, Bob, for helping me begin the show. Tune in tomorrow for the Inside Scoop.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
This is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
You count down. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Guy James Show, coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers area. Glad to have all of you along with us, local people here and people all around the world and across the entire United States, and gosh, our guests that we regularly hear from in Germany and the Nordic countries and South Korea and Australia and New Zealand. Glad to have every one of you along with us today. We're going to try and have an interesting show. I'll tell you what, we've got a busy show, if nothing else, today. We have, as it turned out, three guests today. I don't like to pack that much in, but I pretty much had to today on kind of scheduling. We've got Brady Kiesling and Ann Wright, who are both, well, they both resigned from the State Department. Both of them had a lot of time in. Ann Wright was a colonel, an Army colonel, and former State Department diplomat. She resigned in protest of the Bush State Department diplomacy efforts, and so did Brady. So we'll be having them both on a little later. Ann will be up first right around 3:30. And I think around 4:05 or so, we're going to have Jacob Hornberger, who is the founder of Future of Freedom Foundation. He is a libertarian, and we're going to talk to him today about the Patriot Act and the torture bill. As you might expect, libertarians aren't too hot on either one of those, so we will see. We will see what his opinion is. So, a jam-packed show today. I hope you'll make it even busier. 866-546-5254. We welcome you to call in. 866-546-5254. I want you to join us today. There's a lot of news out there today. Just heard just a short while ago that this ethics panel, Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, who's taking a lot of heat from her Democratic opponent, congressional opponent in West Virginia, informed the committee that she, a Republican, had not been informed about any of the Mark Foley stuff. Mm-hmm. So what does that tell you? If even the Republicans didn't know it on the committee, they were keeping that story very, very close to the vest. So, and also Fordham was going to testify today as well. The truth's going to come out of that thing. I really think it will. I'm pretty sure it will. I have confidence that it will. And I don't think it's going to be pretty when it's done. Also, I just did get this from ABC News. Capito said she knew nothing about the allegations until September 29th, when Foley's conduct became a major Capitol Hill scandal. She said, and I quote, "It disturbs me greatly. I'm very upset about it, and I think it's disgusting, quite frankly." She's called for more members on the page board, more training for those members, and peer counseling for the pages. And meanwhile, they have issued 4 dozen subpoenas. Boehner's been invited to meet with the committee, and he said he welcomes the opportunity. Now, will he backtrack on what he said about Hastert? I wonder. Will Reynolds backtrack on the fact that he said he told Hastert? Well, we'll see if they've circled the wagons or not. But I think the truth is going to come out. I really hope so. And one other very disturbing news story that came out today before I get on with everything here.